Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to drivers that share Mazda's passion that cars make driving matter. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The first set of debates among the Democratic candidates running for president has taken place. The next round follows at the end of this month. Whoever ends up the front runner, it will be African Americans who will be pivotal in making that decision. And that is especially true in South Carolina, where nearly 60% of Democratic voters are black. In the Palmetto State, according to recent polls, former Vice President Joe Biden remains the favorite of black voters, despite the fact the race features two African Americans, Kamala Harris and Cory Booker, though Harris is moving up. In the past, African American Democrats coalesced around one candidate, but with such a sprawling and diverse field, will that happen this time? And if so, when? What issues are most important to these voters? For answers to that, we're turning this hour to some experts. Kenesha Grant is Assistant Professor of Political Science at Howard University in Washington, D.C., and the author of the forthcoming book, The Great Migration and the Democratic Party, Black Voters and the Realignment of American Politics in the 20th Century. And she joins us this morning from a studio at NPR in Washington. Good morning. Welcome.
Good morning, Mike.
Cleve Woodson, you may know from his time at the Charlotte Observer. He is now a national political reporter for the Washington Post, where he joins us for the hour. Good morning to you.
Morning, Mike.
And Antoine Seawright is a Democratic strategist and the president and CEO of Blueprint Strategies, also a political contributor to BuzzFeed News and CBS News, and he's with us via Skype from Columbia, South Carolina this morning. Good morning to you.
Good morning, and how are you?
I'm great. Kenesha, let me start with you. The black vote is not monolithic. So at this stage of the game, can we really say exactly how much influence they will have on choosing a nominee, given how many people are running and the potentiality there for splintering anybody's vote, much less the black vote? It could be any group's vote.
I think you're right that the black vote is not monolithic, and so for that reason, it's kind of hard to do some of the balance of power analysis that I like to do and I think political strategists like to do. But we do know that they turn out to vote in very large numbers for Democrats. And so I think even if it's not the case that they have coalesced around anybody yet, they are an important bloc because getting them out in large numbers is the key to success for any Democrat who wants to be president of the United States. Mm-hmm. And so the Democrats are going to have to work hard to figure out how you get folks into one camp from these diverse camps, and then they're going to have to turn around and figure out how you mobilize them once they have decided on a candidate to get out and vote when the time comes.
In Ebony, Jessica Floyd wrote, quote, "Politicians who want the trust and votes of black women should address an oversight evident in many past campaigns, messaging specifically focused on black women and the issues that impact them." Women in voters in general will have great power in this election. Will black women voters be the most important cross-section of the African-American vote?
I mean, since I'm a black woman, I'm going to go ahead and say yes, they will. But I also think that it's kind of the year of the black woman in politics. It's been the case, you know, as long as we've been participating in politics, black women have been the backbone of this democracy. And we're now getting to a place where people can see that, where we're talking about it and having conversations about it. And that is energizing black women in a way that we kind of didn't need, but it's nice to have. And so I think that black women are really important. I think that the candidates can tell they're important. I'm reading an op-ed from Elizabeth Warren in Essence magazine, where she's talking directly to black women about issues that face them, about infant mortality, about home ownership and entrepreneurship. I see that a bunch of them showed up at the Essence Festival this weekend. And so I think that they know black women are important. And I expect to see that they will continue to court them as voters moving forward in the campaign.
What are their issues, Kenesha? And how do they differ from issues that black men may be more concerned with, or issues that the electorate at large may be more concerned with?
In some ways, their issues are the issues of the electorate at large. They're worried about the economy. They're worried about whether they're going to be able to pay their bills at the end of the month. But they do differ in some ways. I mentioned a couple of them. I think one of the ones that stands out for me as a 35-year-old black woman is this idea of maternal mortality, that black women of advanced age have a higher risk of death when they go in to have children as a thing that's specific to black women. But I think that black women, as the primary breadwinner in many homes, are thinking about about those bread and butter issues that all Americans are thinking about, but affected by them in different ways, affected by the ability to own a home in different ways, affected by criminal justice issues and policing issues in different ways as they worry about sending sons and daughters out of their homes and whether those children will return at the end of the night.
Cleve Woodson is also with us. He's a political reporter for The Washington Post. And the black vote, as I said, will make up 60% of the South Carolina primary voters if they all turn out to vote. But they make up only 20% of the Democratic Party vote nationwide. And that means they're certainly a significant portion of the electorate in South Carolina. What about their significance in the rest of the country, Cleve?
Well, I think there's a couple things. One, I think that's still a very significant number, especially in key battleground states like Pennsylvania and like Michigan. But I think even if you're looking at the electorate at large, I think voters that I've talked to have said that they want to see a candidate, even if it's a white candidate or whatever, to know that they are courting a diverse electorate, know that they're going after every voter from a wide spectrum of everybody. So appealing to African American voters is about more than getting African Americans to vote for you. It's about persuading everybody and convincing everybody that, you know, your cabinet, that the people that you care for look like America. Hmm.
You say that interviews with black voters in Michigan, in Pennsylvania, and here in North Carolina have uncovered deep divisions among those voters about the best way to yield the power they bring to the ballot box. And they are upset, you say, with the broken promises of previous elections and what they view as little progress for struggling communities. What promises are they referencing there?
I spent a lot of time canvassing, talking to voters, and I spent a little bit of time in Flint because in the 2016 election, you know, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, Bernie Sanders all went to Flint. I think Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders opened campaign offices in Flint. And the way that a lot of African-American voters there feel is that promises were made and we're going to, you know, fix your water problem, or there are going to be jobs here, we're going to enact, you know, systematic fundamental change here. And then the election happened. And everything disappeared. Everybody went away. And it's just as they're going into this next election cycle, you know, they see all of these candidates, two dozen candidates, and they're making the same promises. They're saying the same exact things. And so the challenge for these voters is to try to figure out which one of these candidates is just talking, is just pandering, is just making promises that won't be kept, or which one will be there the day after Election Day.
Several years ago, we heard similar complaints from the evangelical community about their support for various Republican candidates down through time, making promises to them and then nothing ever happening, and they became a little disenchanted with that and moved, I think, probably even further to the right. Is something similar happening here?
It's far too early, I think, to prognosticate on where exactly things will come. What I do know is that a lot of African American voters that I've talked to have said, "Look, I'm more open-minded now, but I'm also more skeptical. I'm holding people's feet to the fire. I'm asking hard questions." It's less about what a candidate will do and more about what they have done and whether that is a baseline for how they'll govern and whether or not they'll hold themselves to those promises.
So your track record is more important now than what you say you'll do, because there's no way to prove that you're going to do what you say you do, and you may not be able to do it even if you want to do it because of the influence of Congress. From what you've heard as you've traveled the country talking to people and listening to what they have to say, who seems to have the best track record in their mind in the areas that are most concerning to them?
I met a woman actually in Charlotte at a Friendship Missionary Baptist Church. It was at a Cory Booker event, and she said, "I love Cory Booker. I think he's eloquent and charming and nice." And she loved Kamala Harris. She thought she stood for as an African American woman. And I said, "Okay, so are these the people that you're voting for?" And she's like, "No." And she kind of laughed and she said, "No, I'm voting for Joe Biden." And I said, okay, why Joe Biden, Ms. Rosemary? And she said, "Look, I want." You know, he's been you know, fighting kind of this fight for 40, 50 years. You know, he has, he was Obama's vice president. You know, that track, you know, I know what I'm buying. I know what I'm, I'm getting out of the deal, the good, but also the bad. And kind of having certainty about, like I said, what they'll do the day after Election Day is very reassuring to a large block of the electorate, as opposed to someone that they just don't know. Now, that doesn't mean that people aren't willing to change, aren't willing to pick somebody else or something like that, but it's going to take some convincing.
So the first place the rubber meets the road in this conversation we're having, Antoine Seawright, is in South Carolina. It's the first real test of the support of the African-American voter for various candidates. It's the first primary where African-American voters' numbers are significant and where their support has such weight in the outcome. But you've also said that at this point, polls nationwide and in your state, South Carolina, mainly reflect familiarity with the candidates. I think you said that prior to the first two debates. Is that still the case?
Absolutely. Let me be clear about what I said in September 1st of 2018. I said the road to heaven and the White House runs through South Carolina. And anyone who is flirting with the idea or considering running for president should know that. And that's been very true. And I think we see that by the way the presidential candidates have prioritized the state. And no disrespect to Iowa, New Hampshire, or Nevada, but South Carolina is where the ball game will be. We know that 60% of the people who cast their vote will be African American, 55% women. Most of the states that follow South Carolina into Super Tuesday have very similar demographics, and the issues are still the same: bread and butter, barbershop and beauty salon, Kiki's Chicken and Waffles, Lizard Thicket, and Big T Barbecue issues. And those are the things that make people go to bed at night worrying and make them sit up in the middle of the night because they could not find the answer before they went to bed at night. And when you look at the quality of life issues, as what we talked about and ran on in the 2018 midterms, I traveled this country, 38 states, had responsibility over 68 races in 2018 to make sure we take back the Congress and pick up and play ball in some governor's races and Senate seats, and we were successful collectively. And the bread and butter issues, quality of life issues, were the things that made voters who voted for Trump in 16 come back to the Democratic side in 18. And I don't think we need to recreate the sauce because it tasted good to the voters in 18. I think with the president and his failure to really get anything done legislative-wise, even when Republicans had the Congress, and Mitch McConnell's failure to pass legislation on that the voters are hungry and thirsty for, that impact their quality of life, like the economy, like healthcare. I think that's why we sentenced the Republicans to 2 years hard times in the minority, and I think we can do that next year if we stick to the script.
I'm not sure where I read this, and it's a little off topic given your answer, but you mentioned all these places to eat in South Carolina and where a lot of these political conversations take place when the candidates are there and when they're not. But I read that Bernie Sanders, who all these candidates have been to South Carolina, they blanketed the state in recent weeks, but Bernie Sanders didn't eat at any of these places. He just talked, and that kind of turned some people off.
Well, and I think it's very reflective of his performance in 16, and the way things are going is will be reflective of the way he will perform here in 18. But in 20, no disrespect to Bernie Sanders, because I don't want to make it about one particular candidate. Here's what I know. The candidates who have connectivity are the ones that people view as having electability. To this point, Joe Biden has been the favorite. He enjoys favorability and flavorability in the state and around the country, particularly with African-American voters, one of the most seasoned voting bloc of the African-American vote. And when you unpack the numbers, not national polls, but state polls, particularly in some of the southern states, you also see that African-American women, particularly seasoned voters, enjoy the idea of Joe Biden for president.
All right, we'll come back and talk more about that in a moment. Antoine Seawright is a Democratic strategist in South Carolina in Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, dedicated to those who believe a car should stir one's emotions and deliver a heightened state of driving. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Tux on Listener Funded, 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the influence of the African-American vote in the upcoming Democratic primaries around the country, and particularly in South Carolina, because they have they're the first test of this and the biggest influence of African-Americans at that point in time, because Iowa and New Hampshire, well, they're fairly white. Kenesha Grant is with us. She's an assistant professor of political science at Howard University, author of the forthcoming book, The Great Migration and the Democratic Party. Cleve Woodson is a political reporter for The Washington Post, and Antoine Seawright's a Democratic strategist and president and CEO of Blueprint Strategy in South Carolina. You just mentioned Joe Biden in South Carolina, Antoine, and I know he's very popular there, given that he's a known quantity. We've talked about that with our other two guests. People know what his track record is. They know his association with President Obama. But there are also two African-Americans in the contest. We have Senators Kamala Harris and Cory Booker. Is it safe to say that there's a great chance for splintering of this vote in South Carolina between now and primary time? Or do you think it'll stay solidly Biden going into this primary?
Well, I think there are a lot of environmental factors that are beyond everyone's control that will determine that. I spoke to the vice president yesterday when he was in South Carolina. And I was very clear to him. If what happened in 2008 happens in 2020, when Iowa showed up big for Barack Obama, that changed the game and a lot of the thinking among African-American voters in the state. And that's the real reality. If Kamala Harris or Cory Booker catches fire in Iowa, coming out of predominantly white state, coming into South Carolina, a very predominant African-American state in terms of people who will show up to the polls and vote consistently. The only dynamic, and I think the saving grace for Joe Biden at this point, is the reality of that people have really made their intentions clear about having a pragmatic voice to represent them as our nominee, and also someone that they think can take on Donald Trump. Now, Antoine has said this, and I've been very clear about this. For me, it's bigger than taking on Donald Trump. What I care about is preserving and expanding our numbers in the Congress, making sure we're competitive in down ballot races, especially considering what the Supreme Court just did. State legislative seats and governor's races will be all the more important. And as well as being competitive in the U.S. Senate, because we all know we can have the White House and have the Congress, but if we can't have the Senate, we will not be able to get people confirmed, et cetera. And so all those things come to mind and what's important in a nominee for me. And we have to have someone who can bring the corners of this party back together once we get a nominee. If there's any split or divide in this party, we're going to repeat the sins of 2016, and Donald Trump will continue to occupy the White House.
Let me bring the political scientist back in here, Kenesha Grant, because he just mentioned that some African-American voters are looking to be pragmatic about their choice, the person who's best situated to beat President Trump. This is a Democratic problem, because on the one side, there is that need to nominate the person who can beat Donald Trump. On the other hand, I read in the paper this morning that according to one study out of Chapel Hill, the electorate is more liberal-leaning than it has been at any time since 1961. They're ready for change. They're ready for liberal policies. And there are Democrats within the party who want to see the progressive wing take charge. That puts Joe Biden in a sticky position, doesn't it?
I think it does. I agree with the point about black voters as pragmatists. And I think that much of black life kind of makes you a pragmatist, whether you want to be one or not. But I think that many black people also have dreams and imaginations about what the world should look like. And I think that many folks will be excited about a black woman president or the second black male president. And so for that reason, I think that it's possible that they might end up getting behind a Kamala Harris or a Cory Booker if it seems like it might be possible for them to get elected. I think that we forget one of the things that I think was important in the 2016 election, which is that you have to excite people and get them out to vote. And if you don't get them out to vote in large numbers, then these calculations that we're making about how important the black vote is or how important black women are fall apart. And so for Hillary Clinton, I didn't feel like there was something in that campaign that I could be excited about, that I could hope for. There was no warm and fuzzy there. And so if the message coming out of the Biden camp is going to continue to be, I'm the best guy because I've been in it the longest, or I'm the best guy because you know my name, I think that might work well. If what we assume about people getting out to vote is kind of what we hope best for them. But as a political scientist, I'm a bit skeptical, and I think we have to give something for voters to feel good about. I think we have to give them a positive, happy, uplifting message in addition to highlighting the things that this president has done that are not happy or positive and uplifting if we want to get them out. And if we don't do that, I think folks won't turn out. And so it won't matter how pragmatist we are or have been. If those liberals are not willing to come out to vote for the center, the Democrats will lose. Mm.
You may not have felt warm and fuzzy about Hillary Clinton, but Hillary Clinton won about 80% of the black vote in the 2016 primary. Barack Obama won about 80% in the 2008 primary. Bill Clinton won 70% in 1992. Why? Was it something they said, something they did, something that simply resonated with African-American voters, or was something else at work in those primaries, Kenesha?
I think I want to take a moment and be careful about the difference between the percentage of people, black people in particular, who vote for the Democrats and the numbers of people who vote for the black for Democrats.
Okay.
And so it's one thing to say that we expect 100 people to vote and we expect 70 or 70% of those 100 people to come out. And another thing to say that we got 80% of the black vote, but it was less than 100 people who turned out. That was a kind of convoluted way to say the numbers matter too. It's not enough to get a large percentage of black people to support you. You have to get a large percentage of them out to vote, and then turn around and get a large percentage of them supporting the candidate. In terms of the past Democratic nominees, I think that the situation with Barack Obama was all love and hope. It was excitement. I can't believe this moment is happening, I think most black people felt. I've been waiting to see myself reflected in politics, and so I'm going to turn out to vote for a Barack Obama, if for no other reason than I want to see a black man be the president of the United States. I think there were also policies that he was talking about that folks liked. I think the same is true for Hillary Clinton, but to a lesser degree, and the same was true for Bill Clinton. I think that these candidates had policies that black people believed in. They had policies that made sense for them, made sense for their pocketbooks, made sense for their families, and I think they turned out to vote for them for those reasons.
Cleve, you wrote in the Washington Post that black voters this time are looking for cues that show candidates are not just coming to the black community because they have to. Mm-hmm. And you were writing about South Carolina. That obviously can be extrapolated out to the rest of the nation, correct?
I think so.
Is this new?
Well, I think that with so many candidates, with such a large field, every time somebody goes to an event, they're looking at more than just what a candidate is saying, you know, behind the lectern. Every candidate is going to say something that they think appeals to the people in the audience. That's just how these things are done. But what a lot of voters are looking for is a sign that candidates really actually internally care, and that they're going to continue caring long after they need that vote. So whether a candidate just talks and leaves, as opposed to talking and staying and kind of interacting with the audience, whether they just kind of shout their policy points, you know, from the stage, or they sit down and they listen, you know, they ask questions. Is it a town hall versus, you know, and you know, just a rally or a speech or something? But I mean, I found that voters were even interested in minutia, like if you're at an event where there is food served, did you go back into the kitchen and politely thank the people that prepared it? All of this adds up to a feeling of whether or not this is a person that a voter can trust. And it's surprising how easily a candidate can lose that.
So, Antoine, you've had boots on the ground in South Carolina. You've watched a lot of these candidates come through your state and stump and talk to people and enjoy and eat food with them. And what has been the modus operandi here? What have the candidates who seem to be resonating most been doing on the stump? How have they been interacting with these people?
Well, a couple of things. I think they've made the conversation about South Carolina. The one thing you have to know about our state and this is probably true for southern states, particularly the ones I worked in over the past 15 years. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of promises made in the short term, but they never come through in the long term. And while a lot of people talk about global issues that impact certain, you know, the community at large, they don't make it very personable and talk about how it directly impacts the state. And so what I've seen, I've talked to 21 of the persons who's running for president, and what I've seen and heard from them consistently is they want to know how their running and how their candidacy will have direct impact on communities in these places that they travel to.
Who's doing the best job? Who's doing the best job?
I think it's a mixed bag. I think that depending on the candidate and the ones that highlight the issues, obviously Kamala has been very strong on criminal justice. Biden has been strong on health care. Bernie has had his position on health care. Cory has had his position. You have Jay Inslee on the environment. I think different strokes are different folks. Mm-hmm. But going back to something the professor said, if you look at what happened in the 2018 midterms, I'm just a student of history. Joe Biden was the most requested surrogate that traveled this country for Democrats up and down the ballot. I was there 38 states, and so I know firsthand. And the one thing we heard consistently from voters, black, white, rich, or poor, is that the center is where we have to be if we want to be effective and bring back voters that Democrats have lost. And I love the idea of Kamala Harris running for president. She's a dear friend. But at the end of the day, I just think that voters are going to have to make a decision of whether they want to vote for someone who can give them what they need long-term or short-term. And I think that's the big question we're having as a party. And then the real question about this primary, more so than any other primaries, where do we go from here? Are we going to be a center-left party in which 80% of the people who identify themselves as Democrats say we are? Or are we going to tip to what the Republicans are trying to paint us as and be the liberal party that would drive the car off the liberal cliff?
Cleve, I want to get back to your article about miscues and people looking for miscues. You wrote that members of the Alpha Kappa Alpha sorority in South Carolina, Network of Black Women, have asked Senator Kamala Harris how they can help. And when they asked, all they received back was silence. Has that changed since you wrote that piece? And if not, how do you explain that?
I'll tackle both. One, yes, it has changed. I've gotten some messages from AKAs and from internally from the Harris campaign that there have been efforts to utilize that willing and able and kind of ready to put on their sneakers and go out and stump for her group. You know, it remains to be seen how effective they are in mobilizing that group and in whether that group can persuade other people to vote for Kamala Harris. But the AKAs that I talked to and other groups, you know, that upsetness, that being miffed at the campaign, that doesn't immediately wash away. That doesn't immediately go away. And, you know, some of them have said, does it take a national article? Does it take kind of a nudge from the outside for you to involve us in your campaign? And I think people just have long memories, and they'll just remember that, and it'll all go into the soup when they're deciding who to cast their vote for.
Yeah, Kanisha, pragmatism may come with age and experience. People have some life experience, and they see what the past has brought them or not brought them, and so they might be willing to be to put their vote on the more pragmatic choice. Whereas younger people have a shorter history behind them, and they want something new and different. And I know younger Democrats want the party to be more progressive, and it's very attractive when they hear free college or college debt forgiveness, because they're the ones saddled with it. And the fact mandated minimum wage is something that a lot of these candidates are proposing, and that affects young people as well. Are African-American voters more conservative than they are and pragmatic, or are they in this other camp, this more liberal camp? And is that really dependent on how old they are?
That is a very good question. I talked about this a little bit last week when people were reacting to Kamala Harris's engagement with Joe Biden in the debate. And in that instance, among the black folks I talked to, there was a divide where older people who I talked to believe that she should have treated him with a different level of respect or been kinder to him. Mm. And the younger people who I talked to were very excited about the idea that she would call him to the carpet on the issue of busing and on the issue of being friendly with segregationists. And so I think that it's the case that how black people feel is going to differ based on their age. I think that it's also the case that kind of regardless of how old or young we are, that we want to win. We want to have somebody in office who is going to support black issues. And if that means that we have to go with a person who we're not necessarily in love with, then we know how to do that. We are forced to make these kind of compromises all the time. But I think one of the important things to think about that we haven't really talked about at length is the space between a Hillary Clinton and a Barack Obama in the year 2007. And at that time, she was as far away from Barack Obama, who was behind her in the polls, as Joe Biden is from Kamala Harris or Elizabeth Warren right now. And so this idea that black folks are pragmatist or that we have to go directly to the center and the left is kind of far off and away, I think is something that we should kind of trouble in our thinking about it. We got to trouble that narrative. We got to be critical of it because we have evidence from the past that suggests that whether young or old, if black people believe that the candidate can be viable and that the candidate will get in there and advocate for their issues, that they're willing to come around to something that doesn't really seem to make much sense on the front end to them, but makes sense on the back end once they understand that it is possible to bring them some positive change.
This is a delicate dance, isn't it? go ahead.
Can I say one
thing? Sure, absolutely.
I was quoted in NBC on NBC.com saying this today. They interviewed me yesterday at the Joe Biden rally, and you know, I'm a free agent, so because of my relationship with CBS, I'm a free agent. I can't support anyone in this primary. But what I will say is that my dear friend Bakari Sellers loves to make the argument that this race in 2008 is very similar. I fundamentally disagree. In 2008, we did not have Donald Trump in the White House. The mood of the country and the temperature of our party was totally different. There's no Hillary Clinton and no Barack Obama in this race. The fact of the matter is the president has raised $100 million towards reelection to this point in quarter two, a year out. The urgency of this moment is greater, in my 34-year-old opinion, than it was in 2008. And what Donald Trump has demonstrated and proven to us is that he will do whatever he needs to do to change the tone and the temperature of this country for generations to come, like some of his appointments, like some of his policies. And so I'm a firm believer we can't compare this race to 2008. 2016. This is a totally different race, and our party and the country is different. Therefore, I think we're going to have to govern ourselves different in our thinking. Now, with that being said, I'm not saying that Kamala Harris cannot beat Donald Trump. I'm not saying that any other candidate cannot beat Donald Trump. But I know in this primary, we cannot afford to go across the finish line bumped and bruised up, because when Republicans fall in line, yeah, Democrats fall in love, and that has not worked in our favor in the past.
So I have 10 seconds. Does that mean pragmatism is the order of the day here?
Absolutely not. And I think it would be malpractice for anyone to say that. I think what's going to be the order of the day is the person who will connect with African American voters, because make no mistake, we will decide who the next nominee and the president of the United States
will
be.
All right. More to come. Charlotte Talks on WFAE. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the influence of the African-American vote in the upcoming election, particularly in the primaries, and particularly in South Carolina, given the fact that 60% of Democratic voters there are black voters. Antoine Seawright is a Democratic strategist in South Carolina, president, CEO of Blueprint Strategy, and a contributor to CBS News and BuzzFeed News. Ganesha Grant, assistant professor of political science at Howard University in Washington, and the author of The Great Migration and the Democratic Party, Black Voters and the Realignment of American Politics in the 20th Century, but you can't buy it until January. And Cleve Woodson is with us. He's a political reporter for The Washington Post. Cleve, Vice President Biden has a record, which is part of the challenge, I suppose. It's something you can run on, and it's also something you can run from, because there are portions of that record that have been misconstrued, and portions of that record that are certainly out of step with contemporary Democratic politics. So far, would it be safe to say that most black voters are unconcerned with the portions that are out of step, that they don't seem to care about old comments or even recent missteps? And if that's true, is the same thing at play here as black feelings about the governor of Virginia, who allegedly dressed in blackface while in college, and who black voters have pretty much said, let that go?
I'll start with the first part. Every time Joe Biden has a gaffe or something happens or the debate goes on, I call kind of the smart voters that I've talked to in South Carolina and Charlotte and other places, and I say, hey, has this changed your opinion? Has this made you change your mind about this person? And one person kind of got sick of me calling. And she said, you know, look, I've been following Biden for decades, and so, you know, I'm not going to relitigate him every single time. I think what she means is that it would take something astronomical for those people who are solidly in Joe Biden's camp to jump ship. They're open to other candidates. I think they're certainly, you know, listening to everybody, but they've been following, some of them have been following him since the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And so it's going to take more than a moment, a slip of the tongue, or something. In fact, what I found is that some of them have antipathy to the people who are, you know, going after Biden. You know, I've talked to several people, older black women, who say, you know, I think, you know, Kamala Harris is using, you know, these moments for political expediency. So they're almost more on Biden's side. Yeah. You know, to the other point, I don't know if other candidates get automatically that free pass in other places, because I think Biden has something that with black voters specifically that other candidates don't have. He has an 8-year relationship with Barack Obama. Even in his apology over the weekend, you know, he said over and over again, you know, talking in the past tense, Barack and I did that. Barack vetted me. But, you know, Barack essentially, although Barack Obama hasn't endorsed him, you know, just picking him as vice president gives him just this, I'm not going to say that a bulletproof vest, but it gives him a very strong standing.
Just following up on the Biden record, Kanisha, aside from the controversy that erupted because of his conversation about his association with segregationist senators in a bygone era, it was Joe Biden who helped write the 1994 crime bill that resulted in a high incarceration rate for African-American men. It was a product of its time. Thinking has certainly changed since then, but he does bear that responsibility. On the other hand, Kamala Harris is a former prosecutor, and there are those who have accused her of diverging from the Democratic Party's trend of taking a critical eye toward law and order policies. Does one of these things cancel out the other, or are both candidates carrying baggage that could hurt them with black voters?
I think they're both carrying baggage that could help them with black voters. I think what's going to be important is how they manage these situations. And so Kamala Harris gives a speech a couple weeks ago where she tries to articulate exactly what she was thinking and what her ideas were and why she took the position she took. And I think it would probably behoove Joe Biden to do the same thing in the coming days or weeks. I think that we might see his campaign taking a bit of a pivot. I was surprised to see that he had an apology in South Carolina this weekend. In the past, it hasn't been the case that he has been completely apologetic or upfront with an apology. And so I think we might be moving into a space where he understands that he has to speak directly to some of the issues that might have black voters especially those who are progressive or those who are liberal, looking at him with skepticism.
I'm not sure which. We haven't talked about Pete Buttigieg, the mayor of South Bend, Indiana, and I'm not sure which one of you to ask this question of. I'm curious if his candidacy is viable in the African-American community, given what happened with the police shooting of a black man and the ensuing criticism of Pete Buttigieg by the citizens, the black citizens of South Bend, Indiana, in the aftermath of that, and the fact that he's gay. And that does not play well in the black community. Can he get black support?
Well, I said this to Politico a few days ago. I think that Pete has, and he, make no mistake, Liz, his campaign advisor, is a personal friend of mine. We both work in Andrew Cuomo's world, governor of New York. And so I've said this to her privately, too. I think he has the same math problem that Bernie Sanders had in 2016 when it comes to African-American voters. He seems to be drawing large interest in crowds, and he's raising a ton of money, $24 million, and people are excited about him. But that has not transferred into support among the most loyal and important voting bloc in his party, and that's African-American voters. Part of that is trust. a lot of it has to do with no one to this point, from a big profile standpoint, has been able to validate him in the African-American community. And I said to the same reporters that if I'm Pete Buttigieg and I'm advising him, I would take this money that I've raised and make some serious investments into focus groups, polling, and research to find out why I'm not connecting with African-American voters and what's important and what's on their mind, so I can then craft a message and find a way to penetrate the community. Otherwise, he will be the Bernie Sanders of the 2020 presidential primary.
When he was challenged by African-American voters in his own city and later on, I think, at a press conference, Cleve, he pretty much took the hit. He said, it's my fault. I failed. How does that play?
And he, I think he did the same thing in the debate as well, right? He said that I was unable to, you know, do X, Y, and Z. I think the voters that I talked to have said, look, he seems earnest and he seems sincere, and even that, you know, they like him. But whether that translates into voting for him or to moving your support from the candidate that you support the most and switching to Buttigieg, I agree. I think he has kind of that same math problem. Like it's not just whether you can get people to like him. There's widespread support for him. It's whether or not you can lure those voters away from other people, and that just seems difficult for him at this point.
Among black voters, is there majority agreement that any Democrat would be preferable to the country and to their interests than four more years of Donald Trump, Cleve?
I think so.
Are the objections in the African-American community to Trump substantially different from anyone else who would oppose Donald Trump in the coming election?
I think that's where the opinions of African-Americans dovetail with the opinions of the electorate at large. In fact, I think you're seeing African-Americans, just like any other interest group, having this kind of difficult choice. Do I choose the candidate that most accurately portrays what I want in a candidate, the issues I want, and do I become aspirational, or do I become more pragmatic and pick somebody that I know can get Trump out of office? I think every interest group, but African-Americans specifically, are thinking about that.
Well, I'll say, as the resident black man on this panel, two things. One, I won't go that far and say that, because what I know, I worked for Hillary in 08 and 16, and what I know in 16 is that we had the highest percentage of African Americans vote for the Republican candidate we've had in my lifetime. I think 13% of black men voted for Donald Trump. What I also know is that, it's going back to what the professor said, if we do not have a candidate or a cause to rally behind, you're not going to get African-Americans coming out in large number to support Democrats, and history has proven that time and time again. So who we nominate is very important and matters a whole lot if we want to be successful against not just Donald Trump, but again, some of the other races that will be on the ballot.
I want to point out that Cleve is also African-American, so
yes.
You're not the only guy on the panel that's black. That's okay. The Democrats have this problem, it seems to me, overall, not just with African-American voters, but with everybody. And that is they have to put aside the different splinters of progressivism if they really want to defeat Donald Trump, because they cannot do what they did in the last election and be successful. How do they get the message across that if you really want to defeat Donald Trump, you have to suck it up? If you don't like the nominee, you still have to vote for him. How do you do that?
Him or her? I want to think about, and I want to hear more people talking about Andrew Gillum. I want to hear more people talking about Stacey Abrams, because I think that although they did not win their governor's races in 2018, what they did in Florida and Georgia is incredible. And they were running from the left. They missed it by 30,000, about 30,000, about 50,000 votes, respectively. But I think that if we want to figure out how to bring people in from the left and how we want to understand the center, we got to start by understanding what happened in those campaigns. We got to tweak what happened in those campaigns and build on it to figure out how we get folks from the various parts of the party to come together for a win in 2020.
I don't think you have to say it. I think for most Democrats, I mean, if you look at the candidates that are running in the presidential election, many of them for months did not even mention Trump, because if you turn on CNN, if you turn on MSNBC, if you open the Washington Post, almost like he's there. He's pervasive. And so I don't think Democrats have to be told that you have to rally together in order to beat Trump, because they have 2016. You also have every presidential nominee on the Democratic side, from Bernie Sanders to Joe Biden, saying, you know, if it's not me, if I am not the nominee, let's rally together and let's vote for whoever is the nominee. So I think it just sort of goes without saying. I think everybody knows this. And so the question that people have are, okay, you want to be the nominee. What are you going to do for me? How are you going to help us? What are you going to do after Election Day?
Here's a question I'm loath to ask because I'm afraid what the answer might be. But Kenesha, it could be argued that the election of Donald Trump was in part a reaction to the 8 years of having the nation's first African-American president in the White House. Do black voters worry that either an African-American cannot be elected, or that it would be detrimental in this particular environment if they were elected?
I hesitate to talk about all black voters, but if I was going to do that, I would say that I do think we worry about nominating a black candidate to run against Donald Trump, because I think that so that I don't have to put this on other black voters, but I do believe that Donald Trump's election in 2016 is a reaction to Barack Obama's presidency. And so I think that other black voters probably agree that it might be difficult in this environment, where racism is on public display in ways that it hasn't been in a while, to get a black candidate elected. Now, that said, I think that because I worry in part not only about the folks who voted for Obama and then voted for Trump, but worry about the white people in the Democratic Party who may or may not have voted for Donald Trump, may or may not be willing to support a black candidate. And so I think that if we can get a coalition of allies who are not black to say, we will be there to support you in your candidacy, Cory Booker, or in your candidacy, Kamala Harris, then it might be more likely that we can get black voters to believe that a black candidate can win.
Antoine, from what I've read, Joe Biden and even to a certain degree Elizabeth Warren have attracted more excitement or attention, and certainly garnered more excitement from black voters in South Carolina than the black candidates. Would you say that's true?
Partly, but you know, I'm one of those people who believe polls are what they are. They are simply a snapshot of the moment, of the time, and anything could change the temperature and the tone of a poll, i.e. the last debate. We saw Kamala Harris shoot past everyone on the political highway, and now is in second place in most places. So I think that to this point, most of the polls have been about name ID, and the candidates have enjoyed not being defined by their opponents other than Joe Biden. So I think you're going to see the polls change a lot. I think the consistent thing for Warren and Biden, if they want to remain, you know, one and two going forward, is to continue to have a connection. I think Warren is going to have trouble later on continuing to find her southern groove if Kamala continues to find her groove and find her place in her space as she has been over the past several weeks.
We tend to think of the internet as being ubiquitous, but there are areas of the country where you have to work hard to get access to the internet and all that it provides, and the way that campaigns are being conducted using these social media platforms on the internet. South Carolina is one of those states that has a lot of rural areas in which broadband internet has not made significant inroads. So that means you got to have boots on the ground to reach people.
Yep.
You can't do it with ads on the internet. So are you seeing that in the various campaigns that have come trumping through your state?
Not yet. And what I've told every candidate who's called me for advice, I said to them, and to be successful here, you're going to have to run a high-tech and a high-touch campaign. Yes, you can do your emails and all the digital stuff, but you're really going to have high-touch, meaning going to communities knocking doors, going to NAACP Urban League, going to houses of worship, organizing at the precinct level if you want to be successful. And I think that's what we did in 16 for Hillary. That's what Barack did in 08, and that's why they were successful.
And we'll leave it at that. Antoine Seawright is a Democratic strategist, president, CEO of Blueprint Strategy, and a contributor to CBS and BuzzFeed News. Cleve Woodson is a political reporter for The Washington Post, formerly with The Observer, and Kenesha Grant, assistant professor of political science at Howard University. Look for her book, The Great Migration and the Democratic Party, Black Voters and the Realignment of American Politics in the 20th Century, available in January. Thank you all for the hour. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, committed to Mazda's focus to ensure every element of a car is designed around the driver. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com.